Well, let's go ahead and get started. I will start with the roll call. It's the 21st of September. Mr. Coffin?
Here.
Mr. Conway?
Here.
Ms. Hedrick?
Here.
Mr. Darr?
Here.
Tony Grove is not here. Ms. Bowles is not here yet. Mr. Whitekemper?
Here.
Ms. Kraus?
Here.
All right. I'm here. So we need to start with approving our agenda. Does anyone have any corrections, additions, or other suggestions? We will not have the September 14th minutes this evening.
Did we complete number one on old business last week?
Well, I didn't know based on where we ended up the discussion, so I wanted to make sure, and because Mr. Conway had not been available during that discussion, so I thought we'd revisit it briefly.
I'd make a motion that we approve the agenda.
And I'll second it.
All right, in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Now, we're going to look at the August 30th meeting minutes again. If people received a copy via email and have had a chance to see if the updates were sufficient. Or corrections?
There's an entire question by Mr. Bloom was still admitted. And 90% of Mr. Clark's public comment was made.
I'm looking at the paragraph that has been added that says Mr. Chris Bloom stated that Mr. Windsor had mentioned earlier there was a cost of service study done for water utility in 2012, adding that he wanted to know when the last increase was done for the electric utility. Is that not the question Mr. Bloom asked?
Is it about the 10-year capital plan? Any question about the 10-year capital plan?
Well, in the document that Mr. Clark added to our task force's email exchange that was sent out by city staff to the task force members. It seemed to read from Mr. Clark's addition that was his question about the 10-year plan.
I don't believe so.
So Jim, was it or wasn't it? What's the deal?
Do you remember?
About whether we had a 10-year plan?
No, about who asked the question.
Sorry, I was
slow. Right.
Was it part of a motion?
I'm sorry?
Was it part of a motion?
Nope.
Just a question.
Let's go on.
Okay, and as for the idea that 90% of Mr. Clark's comments were left out, I'm very uncomfortable adding direct transcript to our minutes. It's inconsistent with the way we have kept minutes to date. Several of the direct comments in that transcript are expressions of personal opinion rather than substantive questions about the content. But in trying to be fair and open and make sure that we are transparent in our work on this task force, I want to make a couple suggestions. I drafted an abbreviated to a transcript description of Mr. Clark's comments that I would like us to review. And I encourage anyone at any time during public comments or in submission to the task force to write whatever they want about our work, including subsetting out pieces of transcription. But yes, I do.
Well, Madam Chairman, for what it's worth category, I had some extra time, so I examined Robert's Rules of Order, the newly revised revision, and within the document, there's a question posed. That was question number 15. Isn't it necessary to summarize matters discussed at a meeting in the minutes of that meeting in order for the minutes to be complete? The answer says, not only is it not necessary to summarize matters discussed at a meeting in the minutes of that meeting, it is improper to do so. Minutes are a record of what was done at the meeting, not a record of what was said.
Interesting perspective. I did also check with the city attorney today, one of the city attorneys, and looked at the Missouri Sunshine Rules and what you're legally required to record from public meetings is attendance and votes on action. So that's sort of consistent with the Roberts Rules.
And if that helps you out, I also had some other extra time. So I did also looked in the Missouri Sunshine Law, open meetings and reference law, and on page 7 it says what you're saying. That's in section 610.015. Says votes how taken. All votes should be recorded. Any votes taken during a closed meeting shall also be taken by roll call. So.
Okay. So yes, and the other thing that Mr. No said was that a consistent approach is useful. So rather than having a direct transcript, I've tried to summarize the comments.
I think I think generally speaking, the way we've worked, to me, there's been a concerted effort to transcribe what was discussed, and I think there's Mr. Morgan here probably would attest to it, and the other ladies, that it's sometimes very difficult to get everything, but. I think there's been a real concerted effort to do that, and that there's not any blatant omissions of what was said or whatever. That there's been a good concerted effort, and then I think the other thing that's worthy is that the staff has always been willing to revise them as we have requested. So,
I tend to disagree on Mr. Clark's comments. The first version of the minutes that was sent out, I believe, said that Mr. Clark made several comments, but he never asked a question. Which?
So now where are we?
I think we need to be consistent with everybody's comments.
Yeah.
Treatment of everybody.
Yeah.
Well, on the page that Mr. Clark chose to send out of his own comments, they were comments and not questions. The one question he asked, Mr. Windsor offered to answer, and he told him he didn't want his answer.
He just didn't want to take up his time before you cut him off again.
Well, here's what I'm proposing as a response to Mr. Clark's concern. Is it adequate?
What is the response?
The addition of this
addition
information.
Of the minutes. Okay.
Right.
Gotcha.
This would be addition to what's already been.
Yes.
Yep.
Listed.
Yep.
I think that's overly accommodating.
I'll second your motion.
I move. So moved, Pat.
I never got time to study and review it.
Well,
I was going to suggest basically that even it could be even shortened more than that. I would, my thought was you could say, Mr. Clark, make comments about this, 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 and this, and this. And you know, then they're in there, and if somebody wants the full length of what he said, they could watch the video. So, yeah, I agree. I think this is overly accommodating, but acceptable.
The video is a full record.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and do our meeting minutes...
Just audio.
Yeah, it's just audio.
I don't mean this to sound the way it might sound, but our meeting minutes don't have to be approved by people that make public comments, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're as a group voting in at least a majority, we don't have to be unanimous either. And I would make a motion that we add these to the minutes and approve them.
I second that.
Let's take the first motion first.
The first motion was Jen's.
Jen.
Mine actually wasn't originally a motion. I was stating that I thought it was accommodating, and I think you thought I said that I was making a motion.
But this would be the minute. Yeah.
I think that's the same thing that Kim was saying. Okay. Do we want to formalize that one more time for the record?
Kim made the motion, Jen seconded it, that we approve the minutes. And just to be clear, nobody else had any other additions or corrections to no other part of it.
Correct.
With the added statement to accommodate Mr. Clark's email concern. Okay, it's been motioned and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Duly noted. Okay, so let's get back to the substantive piece. Mr. Whitekemper sent a revised version, and I know that Mr. Conway had said you're bringing some pieces for us to look at.
Yeah, it's just the same thing. It's just revised revision that's been revised to make it the latest revision.
And you have new copies for everybody?
You know I do.
Because I don't have the other copies. I missed
the
meeting.
I do.
Bill, this is yours?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
To replace the one we talked about last week?
Yes.
Yes. So,
I tried to separate out the recommendations, just one utility per recommendation.
That's,
and one recommendation per mm-hmm. line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I saw the second one, I failed to do that, but we'll address that when we get to it.
I also like your the subset of discussion items where your questions are clearly stated. But let's start with the matters most appropriate to our discussion of Mr. Windsor's presentation, if that's all right.
Certainly.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Do you want to hand out yours?
Oh, I certainly can. What I've done is that on the electrical system in the downtown area, that one, what I did there to provide some historical narrative for the report, and then at the very end is the substance of the recommendation, and what you'll see at the end is it's been brought to my attention. It is recommended to the City Council that the proposed Mill Creek Electric Substation be built as originally designed to be connected to by appropriate electrical transmission lines to benefit the downtown area as well as the city's entire electrical system.
that's a side benefit that happens when you just hook it up electrically. And that there's two points to that. The first one, it's changed because it's brought to my attention that that project is on the current electrical system capital improvement project funding list. So it's there and it's ready. And then the second one, I tried to change that, Cody, some of that verbiage on the administrative delay to pinpoint it just to the way that if they move forward on the building of the Mill Creek substation, you would find that if the Mill Creek substation is the answer to the downtown, which it appears that it is, that you would not want to undo the administrative levy until such time that the substation is built, because it would still, until some time that it's built and put in place, you still have the 2 megawatt problem. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're not going, we're not going to go as a group to go beyond the Mill Creek substation as far as how the feeders are brought into Mill Creek substation.
Right. Yeah.
Mill Creek substation has to be fed and brought into the downtown to basically serve capacity to the downtown area.
The only thing that, and I don't know, I don't have exact wording on how we would address it in this exact thing, is me personally, I would still be a little hesitant to recommend, and I know you've kind of couched it by saying evaluate, so you're not necessarily saying, or we're not necessarily saying, to keep the administrative delay, but I brought it up before that we got the 2 megawatts, let's use it before we set a delay. Personally, that's how I would feel.
Oops, say that again. Say it again.
I would prefer not to enforce a delay while we still, technically from what I've heard, have 2 megawatts of adequate extra capacity.
So you're telling me you would use that up?
Yeah, I think that's what it's there for.
From an engineering standpoint, I disagree.
I do too.
It's capacity, but you should be planning for that capacity.
You have to have some.
That's what the engineering report that said the 8 megawatts. That's what I mean, because it's 10. I mean, you could look at it now and say you have 10 megawatts of additional capacity, but once you take in your worst case and your failures, you have 2 megawatts. What's the point of doing that analysis? Why didn't that analysis say we don't have any capacity left?
That's what
you're saying. Yeah. I mean, there's capacity left, but it's getting very narrow.
The margin is getting low.
That should have been factored in on the analysis of what's
correct.
Additional capacity. You know, if it's not additional capacity, it shouldn't be stated as additional capacity.
Mm-hmm. What's the NERC requirement? The 8 megawatt. What do we have?
No, the NERC is not.
But that's already been subtracted. And that's where we end up with the 2. Is that right?
Well,
that's just a failure, or
that's what they call N-1. It has to do with reliability contingencies. Yeah. So if you lose a feeder or a transformation to serve, so you lose a single source, but not a second source. If it's a second source, that would be N-2, which that capacity would be gone. That'd be outages in the community downtown.
If there's 2 catastrophic failures.
Right.
But the 2 is... That's
the challenge, I think, the 2 is there's 2 megawatts available capacity at this juncture, but they could go quickly. And can we build up fast enough to restore that, or will it become a roadblock to where developers are moving so fast that we'll have to stop the development because we're waiting for the transfer?
That's what a delay is.
Okay, I think does it make sense then, let's see, Cody, that this is our recommendation, then we leave it to the council as to how much risk they want to take?
I'm okay with saying evaluate and putting the administrative delay in the recommendation. I just want to make it clear that I don't necessarily, and I could be outvoted here, obviously, or we could, we don't have to just go on what I'm saying, but just my personal feeling is I wouldn't want the council to enforce an administrative delay right now when the engineers tell me that we have 2 megawatts of additional capacity.
Have we just already determined how we're going to handle some of these recs that we aren't unanimous
on? Yeah, I think you got a good point there, Kim. The question, do we have to decide tonight? No.
We don't have to have 100% agreement on everything we recommend, right?
Well, no, and I don't think we got to decide tonight. I think this is a draft recommendation. I think
we could get the wording better that everybody
can get. Yeah, and then we could continue to mull it over, and others that have ideas and
the question that I would add too, I know that's what Ryan mentioned, the 2 megawatts of capacity, but is that coincident, or is it, you know, I mean, well, how is that capacity defined?
Well, I think it's
defined. A lot of times you use coincident peaks, which means all your buildings are going to be at the peak at the same time, or non-coincident peak.
I think it allows you some
variability in the load, so how much of that 2 is really available.
I think you have to come to a conclusion reading that first paragraph of historical perspective downtown load serving centers, I think, because that's where it says this gives a realistic, the last sentence says this gives a realistic spare capacity of 2 megawatts. So you kind of got to go through the verbiage there and sort out in your mind as to the variability and what that what that really means.
Challenge, it could split a developer. In other words, you take the margin down so tight, it could split a developer's project where it's the last guy's already committed.
Okay.
By the time he gets his engineering estimates on how much electrical demand that is going to take, it may just stop his project. You know, why he's expended cost, because there's no margin for error.
I think the answer or assistance in getting in an answer just walked in the room.
You're on the hot spot.
Mr. Electrical Engineer.
You'll have to repeat the question. Sorry.
You would throw it out there, I throw it out there, you want to?
Go ahead.
Well, our question is on the 2 megawatt available capacity in the downtown region, based on Ryan's analysis. Is that assuming that 2 megawatt a coincident peak or non-coincident?
I guess the answer would be a non-coincident or not. I guess it would really be a coincident peak because we don't really have the meter to divide it out into like a time frame. So we just look at the time period. What's the largest we see over this period of time? Individual entity, and then you add them together. So it's really put together and then viewed as a group, not individually, and summed together. Does that answer?
Yeah.
And maybe another part of the question would be, like with Cody, what his concern is there, Tad, is that so let's say that the council would move forward with the recommendation and build the Mill Creek substation, and so what would be the position of the department in approving projects that would consume the 2 megawatts? Is that at the question, Cody, kind of?
Well, I think, well, I guess I would phrase it, and maybe this is what you're getting at, but I would phrase it as, right now, what's your policy? You have 2 megawatts of spare capacity. You would allow a developer to use that. You're not stopping anybody from using that 2 megawatt spare capacity right now, are you?
That would be correct. We had a very similar situation when we put our Rebel Hill line in, where we were kind of running out till we could get that distribution circuit extended there. And so we kind of worked with people to say, you know, you applied for more, when do you plan to need this? And so we would work with people that their timing and our timing coincided. And if it didn't, we would have to make people aware that for a period of time, they may not be as reliable on our system as we would like.
So we put the risk back on the developer to say it's not available yet. You could build, but you're creating risk for all the downtown area.
I thought there was an administrative delay in place right now.
There is.
Okay.
The administrative delay is still in place. And it's in place until when?
End of the year, right?
Sometime in December.
Sometime in December. So let's see, Cody, as a practical matter, that we get our report done and in October, late October, November, and it gets to the council in November, December, or whatever, and then for them to digest it and react to it and take action would be past the first of the year. And so then administrative delay may be a thing of the past and not be pertinent.
What you're saying, though, is you could take all that so the reserve is zero, and then the administrative delay.
Yeah, I'm fine with having an administrative delay if the engineers say we don't have any spare capacity.
Yeah, it's been consumed. There's no more capacity.
That makes sense.
Mr. Johnson, what's good engineering practices?
Well, good engineering practices is that we feel comfortable we can meet our demand every hour of every day of the year, and so with electricity, as you know, it's not that you can't meet it most of the time, it's just you get to the point where there's a few hours you're requesting. So it comes to the point of what's your risk and what's your contingency plan. Yeah. But we would rather not push our system to the limit to where we're at a risk like that. That would be the good engineering approach.
All right, so why don't we just leave it as is, Cody, and as we move to conclusion, then we may need to hit the delete button there for number two, then.
I do have a question about this last sentence. This would relate only to electrical infrastructure.
Yeah.
I understand, but why would anybody want a permit for anything if they couldn't get one for electricity?
Good question. My thought there was that since our task was just electricity.
Okay, then, yeah, but be specific there.
Yeah, it'd be specific to that, and
it's kind of implied. You almost don't need that last sentence.
Yeah, but I just...
It is implied.
It's important if you're going to have an administrative delay to have it for a reason.
Yeah.
For a demonstrable reason.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm good leaving it like that for now.
All right.
I think, it's very close, essentially. Not like up in arms or anything. Are you going to be incorporate just, I guess this is a question for everybody, but Bill's electric recommendation, are you going to incorporate whatever the group agrees on
into the draft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the way it
works. Number five was pretty closely related to what you're talking about.
Oh, let's see. Yeah.
Five are general recommendation.
Yeah.
I had
what page?
Number five.
Yeah, I'm at the. The first part of the. The first part of this is just the lead in to the electrical. It's the historical narrative that we have for each section. As we get to the drafting the whole document, then I think you're right. Cody would mesh the two to incorporate all the recommendations.
I had three recommendations, just, I don't know, very rough. And I think these just came from the staff's presentations, but explore demand rate billing for residential class customers. Is that something that they were wanting to do, I think?
Demand rate billing?
For residential class. What you were wanting to investigate there, like, see what they mean.
We are not at the point of having the metering necessary, but that's certainly.
That was my second part of the second one, kind of
about
phasing
in for residential customers. Basically, anybody less than 25 kW right now. Which could be small commercial and residential, because you're already doing demand rate billing for anybody over 25 kW.
And that's where it sounded like you wanted to head for, and like, you know, ultimately you would like to get there. And that was another part of my recommendation, was phasing in smart metering AMIs as it becomes technologically and more billing appropriate. And then you had said something else that I kind of tried to use as a basis of a recommendation: reduce payback of solar energy to be net zero, as opposed to the current practice of incentivizing solar by increased payback rates.
Well,
you had said something about that, because right now we pay back
more
than what we actually.
Yeah. The for instance, Ameren pays about 3 cents. We pay over 7 cents. And what the state law says, what is equitable to everybody else, it's an energy production, so we should be returning the energy value to solar customer. Right now, because of how our structure is, we not only return the energy, but also the infrastructure that's part of the kilowatt hour that we collect, and so we're giving that back.
I think the state groups call that an avoided cost, right?
Avoided cost of energy is the state requirement, but that's not how we have evolved. And so,
but as you see it, wouldn't that be something you would like to see investigated? Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Those were what I just had, and I can write them out and email them to you, but
okay,
just so everybody knew what I was thinking and was going to be emailing. Right.
In regards to solar, and it's probably more of a question for Tad, but do you have provisions for people tying into solar for safety reasons? Do they have to have a transfer switch, or your ability to switch them off?
Right now, just for the smaller units, and I should say it's kind of size, right? I mean, the bigger you are, the more of a risk that you pose, and the more of a study and protection we expect out of the installation itself. So the smaller ones, it's more of a just operate behind the meter, whereas you know what's going on with the protection and switchovers. But once you get bigger, there's more modeling and more protection requirements, even to the point, I think, insurance.
I just talk about line protection for the linemen, that if you have a power outage and you still have a live generator and solar panels or batteries, I mean, do you have provisions written in for that, for isolation?
There is
isolation,
yeah, there's a
disconnect. There is an additional disconnect that a regular customer wouldn't have.
Right, yes there is.
Okay.
All right, we got that. Okay, then, Madam Chairman, let's see, to help out as best I could in Bill's electric recommendations under number 2, the MTFI recommends commission a third party to review the city's current methods of accounting for utility depreciation, determine the city's in compliance with requirements in the city charter and city ordinance to establish and appropriately fund a water electric depreciation fund. And so I have made a run at that and offer the following eight options to get to the bottom of that, based upon my 41 years of experience in public finance. It's item 2 under electrical is what that is, Tracy.
Right. Yeah, I just wanted to make a note.
Okay. So.
You have a copy.
Yes, sir. So, what's the question? The question, this came about through the DLC's task force, and I went there and I gave testimony based upon my experience as to how depreciation is expensed in the water line department and how it flows from the revenue statement to the balance sheet, and it's real, it happens, and that's how we finance the capital improvement program for, I know, at least 26 years. And so that was part of their recommendation, and so there was a written response from the city manager and the finance director and so on, and to address that concern. And I think those that were questioning it didn't think that that was the answer. It is very specific in the charter and specific in the ordinance in regards to the depreciation fund. And the thing that we would need to recognize when you read that material, it goes back to 1948. Right? And so you can ask yourselves, have things changed since 1948? Probably have. But anyway, so what I've done here is I've listed 8 possibilities to look at what the mayor and the council may want to consider as determining how that how are we in compliance. If we are, fine. If we're not, then what do we have to do to become in compliance? And there's different avenues of expertise that can be called upon to give an opinion on that. And so starting out, it's since the requirement is in the charter, it takes voter approval. So make the financial determination that depreciation fund concept is no longer needed by the department based upon the changes that occurred in governmental accounting since 1948. And vote on it to remove it based upon adequate justification. And then what will the election cost be to the city to change the charter? Number 2, have the city legal department solicit the legal opinion from the city's bond council to render an opinion of compliance or non-compliance with the existing charter, existing bond ordinances, or other city ordinances. If not in compliance, what would be some of the options to obtain compliance? And what we're seeing here is in our difference of opinion, and you know, the difference of opinion, say, from the DLC versus the difference of opinion from the city staff, that what can we do to get a independent review, okay? And the expert is bond counsel. Does everyone know what role bond counsel plays? Well, bond counsel is a specialized legal firm that issues opinions that when you issue revenue bonds, that you've done it according to state and federal laws. And what that does for the bond investor, the one that buys the bonds, by having a bond counsel opinion, they have the assurance that those bonds have been issued according to state law and federal law, and that it takes away the risk of you, of the investor. That gives you assurance that it's been done correctly, and that you can seek legal options if the issuer of those bonds don't pay. Okay, and so the city has used the bond counsel in the issuance of all their bonds that they've issued. So. The idea would be that the city legal department would solicit bond counsel. An example would be like Gilmore and Bell from Kansas City.
And so every time we pass a bond, it's reviewed by the bond counsel.
Yep, they issue an opinion. Yep, right. Every time. Okay, and then the bond ordinance that's adopted by the council, it outlines the accounts that the city has to establish to assure the bond purchaser that you set those accounts up so that you operate your system properly so that they in turn will get paid. And generally the funds are an operational fund operation and maintenance fund, replacement extension fund, and a bond reserve fund. And sometimes there is a surplus fund, and sometimes back in 1948, there was a depreciation fund established, okay? And the bond reserve fund is a fund that is equal to one annual payment, so that by some circumstance that you have an emergency, financial emergency, you can't make your payment, they can take the money out of the bond reserve and pay the bondholder and still be creditworthy.
Typically an annual payment.
It's one annual payment, right. And then the replacement extension account is just what it says, that you fund those. And the way that that the Water and Light Department has worked for, I know for the last 26 years, is that the bond reserve fund is fully funded, and the replacement extension fund, which is that $1.5 million, has never been, used, but it's in there and it's never touched. It just, and what that does for you when you go to issue bonds again, the bond rating agency will look at your financial statement and say, oh, their bond reserve fund is full and their replacement extension fund is full. Oh, we'll give them a double A rating. That's how that works, okay? And so what I'm saying it too is we would get the experts. They would review all the bond ordinances since.
The bond council would be considered third party, right?
Right, third party independent, yeah. And they are the experts.
Water Light doesn't issue their own bonds. It's the city. Yes, they issue their own bonds?
Yeah. Well, the way that all the bonds out of the Water and Light Department are water and electric revenue bonds. When you issue the bonds for an electric bond issue, you're also pledging the net revenues of the water system, which is operated as a separate enterprise. But from a technical bond paying capacity, you are pledging the net revenues of the Water and Light Department. But the way that the finances are structured is that if you're issuing bonds for electrical purposes, you make sure that the bond payment of those water and electric bonds come just from the payment of electrical charges, and then vice versa, the same for the water. Okay. But when you look in the city's CAFR, you will always see the bonds that are issued were water and electric revenue bonds. Okay, so that's one independent review that could be done. Yes?
So just let me make a naive statement back to make sure I've got it.
Yeah.
Okay, so when the bond council does a review of any bond, part of what they look at is the financial structure that the city uses.
Right, and the account that you set
up. In the context of our city's governance structure.
Right, and what they will go into the finances of the city and look at what accounts have been set up according to the bond ordinance and say, yes, you're in compliance. Nope, you're not in compliance. Now, what happens, what you have to recognize over time, say you started in 1948 with a water electric revenue bond and it called out for certain accounts, okay? Once that bond issue is paid off, all that goes away. Then you go to the next one that was issued and it will call out the accounts that you have to have. And then you issue another bond issue and it will modify those accounts, okay? And then when this one's paid off, those all go away. And so each time bond council gives their opinion, they have gone back and tracked all those to make sure of what the account should be as of the day of the new issuance. It's a little complex to...
So sort of like a review of deed of trust when you buy a piece
yes,
of property.
Yeah, the chain
that's
of...
That's the job of the bond council.
Right, the chain of ownership to yeah. Yep. That's a good comparison. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. Then the next one is that you'd have the city's finance director solicit a professional accounting opinion from the city's annual auditor by including this request in their scope of work for conducting the next annual audit and render an opinion of compliance or non-compliance with the existing charter, the existing bond ordinances, or the city ordinances. If not compliance, what would be some of the options to obtain compliance? Okay, then you're getting in another independent review, and this is common practice for auditors, certified public auditors, to review these accounts and the bond ordinances. This is not.
We recommend three. The recommendations could be go back to go bring a bond council review. That could be one of the recommendations. Mm-hmm. After the first, if just a financial review, depending on.
No, the CPA would target the exact same thing as bond council.
Right.
They would
just identify whether they're complying with the charter or not.
Right, and the other part of it, it's an independent review. It's very common for them to do it. They I've seen that done lots of times. But what it do is just tag on to the annual audit. We just say, we want you to do what you ordinarily do in the city audit, plus we want you to look at this issue and then render opinion of what we need to do. All right? Then the fourth one, now that's not as independent, but we have a new city finance director, and she is a certified public accountant as a professional, and have her render her professional opinion. Now, will we get as far with her opinion maybe as we would with the city auditor or bond council? You know, probably not. But she's a certified public accountant, is a professional, and knows these matters. And
I'm sure she's aware of this sort of question or controversy. Has she addressed it?
No, she's aware of it. I know she's aware of it.
I was impressed that she questioned Rylos the other night.
Pardon?
So I was impressed that she questioned the $600,000 that she was proposing to write off.
Oh, yeah. Knocked
it down to $180,000.
Yeah. But anyway, that's another, that'd be the in-house part to do it. Okay. Now, as we move to five, now five would be an approach that modify the wording on the Water and Light Department balance sheet under current assets that refer to cash and cash equivalents, and that is an attachment. This is that balance sheet, all right? And it's the current assets up at the top, all right? And that rename that account. And rename it to cash equivalents, and then in parentheses put depreciation fund. And why would you do that? Well, that's where the money, when you expense depreciation on the income and expense statement, and you conform to budget, okay, you don't pay that depreciation to anybody. It falls to the bottom line, all right, as net revenues, and then it comes over to the balance sheet, and you put it in the reserve account. And so you, instead of what's happened here is you can just rename that account and call it a depreciation fund, because that's where the depreciation comes from. Okay, another option would be six in the budget document, and I've attached that there for you. In the budget document, look under account 877-000. It says depreciation. That's where it's expensed. All right? And you can say that's just the water utility that you have. That's just the water. And you can see in the FY 2017 budget, they're expensing $3,063,432 of depreciation. Okay, so you ask yourself, well, where does that number come from? Okay, accounting wise, over here you have your asset books, and all the assets go into the asset books, and then you follow industry standards in assigning a useful depreciable life to that asset. Okay, and you take the amount of the asset divided by the years, that gives you the annual amount that you depreciated. And so thanks to the electric and water system, you got all these facilities, and it's a major. Do we have one person that does that, Jim?
What's that?
Keep the asset book.
There is an accountant that's designated for that, yes.
And then think of you annualize that, multiply across, you add down for fiscal year 2017, that number is $3,063,000, and then we expense it on the income and revenue statement. Okay. And so what I'm saying there, just change that account and say depreciation funding, and then put in parentheses, not expense. Okay. All right. Number seven, check all existing water and electric bond ordinances since the bonds obtained voter approval to identify the current required financial accounts to be established. This most likely would be done in option two. The ordinance refers to a 1948 bond issue. How did the city move away from the 1948 bond ordinance once it was paid off and issued other future bonds that required voter approval and change the required accounts? And so what I'm saying here is if it takes voter approval to change the charter, okay, and the charter has these accounts, and you get voter approval to issue the bonds that have these accounts, then you've received voter approval. Okay? See how that would work? That would be a legal interpretation.
That's legal value, baby.
Okay? But that's another angle at it. Okay. So that what I'm saying is that you receive to change the charter takes voter approval to change that account, but in bond issues you get voter approval and that would allow you to change the accounts.
Let me say it in layman's terms to make sure I understand what you're saying. So in 1948 they had a bond that they dealt with via charter. And since then, we've passed bond issues, and the requirements of bond councils as those bonds are passed may have a different set of
accounts,
and so they've evolved over time.
Yep. But that needs to be verified and reviewed and
documented.
And
documented.
Yeah, documented, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the last one, another way of approaching it, is in the department's official CIP document, make a header note or a footer note that says, funded by enterprise funds via depreciation expensing, which is the realization of net revenues by staying within the annual budget and the issuance of revenue bonds. That's how the CIP is funded, is through enterprise funds, through depreciation, and through bond issues. And you just note that that's a depreciation. And that's a pretty, that one is less documented, or it can create less validation or whatever I want to say to do it. Okay.
Number eight is a little opaque when I try to read that. I'm not quite grasping.
Okay, to help you out, Kim. No, the way it works is the CIP is the capital improvement program, and so you ask the question, well, where do we get the money to fund the CIP? Well, the way we do it is we expense depreciation, and we balance the budget for the expenses, okay? And then if we follow budget, we don't pay that depreciation to anybody. It falls down. It's net revenue. They take it and put it over into the cash assets. Then each year when we look to do the CIP, the funding of the CIP, then we look as to how much money we have there, and that's what funds the CIP. And all I'm saying is on the CIP budget or the document, just put funded by depreciation, and it's the trail is there. I mean, it's when you look at account 877000, it's pretty plain that that's expensed and it's not paid to anybody, and the balance budget, the budget balances every year,
part in parentheses seems extraneous. I think it got
Well, it
complicated what you were trying to say.
Well, it is complicated a little bit. If you don't, you know, it's like, it's kind of like this, Kim. I follow this for 41 years. I've seen a jillion financial income and expense and revenue statements and balance sheets, and I've reviewed audits, and I've been a loan officer to make the credit decision whether we buy the bonds or not buy the bonds, and been to all the bond ratings, and it's you know, to me, with my experience, it just really makes sense, and we do it. And again, Mr. Winslow attested that's the way we generate enterprise funds to do our CIP. Jim, help me out. How far off the base am I?
I would add that we do use the funds for other things too, but I mean, it's certainly the concept is that depreciation, because it is a non-cash expense that is budgeted.
We don't pay it to anybody.
We are reinvesting it in the utility.
Right.
Either by paying the debt service on bonds and also by investing it directly in the CIP as enterprise funds. That's correct. We do that.
But it's ultimately the value of an asset whose value dwindles from year to year, right?
Pardon?
It's just ultimately the value of a dwindling asset, the current value of a dwindling asset.
Right, and as it is on the books.
When you talk expensing and then shifting it to revenue, it starts getting, to the layperson, starts getting,
well,
non-accounting person too, by the way.
Well, that, but it probably, instead of saying,
seeming more difficult than.
Well, instead of expensing, it should be a non-expense. And the reason you say non-expense is because you don't pay it to anybody. Even though it's in the operating budget.
And you're not paying yourself for it either, and you're shifting it over to the
revenue. Right, because it's in the rates.
It's a way of recognizing the loss of value of your infrastructure.
Right.
In the budget. And that, you know, depending on the what it is, it could be, have a 10-year life, it could have a 20-year life. Water mains are, you know, 50, 60 years that they're depreciated over. So it just depends on the particular asset, and then, you know, you can take the value and you spread it over that year. It's a straight line depreciation that you're seeing. We're recognizing that it's going to wear out, and we're going to have to replace it at some point. Whether it hits on that or it hits before or after is, you know, but it's a way of saying it's the total value of your asset. This is the amount every year that it is reducing with wear.
Yeah. And so in summary, what my approach here is, I think there's a number of options to get at the question of this issue and lay it to rest and move on.
John, I kind of see 5 through 8 as more remedies.
At no cost.
Yeah, no cost. But it doesn't provide the third party audit to say, yes, they're doing it correctly, and here's some recommended changes within your accounting system to make it more transparent to everyone.
If I had to recommend any of those, I'd recommend number 2.
Yeah, I'd say 2 or 3.
Yeah,
I agree.
And so.
Trey, do you have Carol posted on the Task Force Google site?
I don't see what we can.
Yep.
I think with some slight, or not with, but I mean, just there's just some slight wording differentiations. I think that's essentially what Bill has gotten to.
Okay.
I'm in favor of what Bill had said. I think it's in general. I mean, this wording's a little better that you have for number 2 or number 3. He was just a little more generic just by saying third party. You're trying to be a little more specific.
Yeah.
So.
And
seems like it's the same thing.
I'm in favor of one of those two. I'm not making this up. I mean, I've been down this road.
Yeah, for us to recommend 5 through 8, it kind of makes an assumption that we believe everything is being done correctly. And we're just recommending it.
Right. But I like the
terminology change to demonstrate that. But it'd be better to have a third party.
I do.
And go, yeah, they're doing it right. But we recommend these changes to clearly identify that that this is being handled properly per charter.
And to the, you know, the next last paragraph, that's just my opinion as to what I think has happened is that that each new bond ordinance has changed the naming of the required accounts, and that since 1948, and that the changes in governmental accounting industry since 1948, those have changed, and that the changes in the standard utility accounting industry since 1948.
It's possible the council may look at this and prefer to change the charter versus doing other things, but that's their call.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, that was my attempt to.
Do we have a financial advisory commission?
Yes. Well, not a commission. There's a financial advisory board.
Would it be appropriate to have them look at these? In your opinion?
That'd be hadn't thought of that, Bill. Yep, they could.
Serves on that board. Got a who's on the board?
It's a citizen appointed advisory board.
I'm not going out for that.
Nine number four, I believe. John's on it. John Clark.
Are you okay with, Bill, are you okay with, I mean, maybe you want to review it, but and in general, are you okay with him replacing your...
I like to have the City Financial Advisory Board review it and give a recommendation.
Yep. I think you could merge, I mean, you could merge that, add that.
You could merge three and four together. We don't really have to define, two and three. Whether it's bond council or a third party, CPA that does it, we just say or
right,
bond just council
name all,
or name third party CPA.
Right. Now just name all three of them and not
or, right
and not receive
to the third party review and let the council decide what they feel is most appropriate.
And then, like Bill says, then put a deal in there about the financial advisory board
would review whatever these reports said. Mm-hmm.
And the Financial Advisory Board reviews the bond documents as they issue bonds.
Right.
In fact, that's one thing they do, the Financial Advisory Board. They review the city audit and make a report to the council. Okay.
Okay, so we're...
And let's see, excuse me.
No, please,
and the same thing happens in the sewer utility. Is that right, Jim?
The decrease rate.
Yeah, same thing happens.
All of
the utilities.
Yeah, all of the utilities, yeah.
So, and the issue about the depreciation fund alignment is... for all utilities.
The stormwater.
Well, stormwater.
Do you have assets in stormwater that
we
you
do,
depreciate?
There is depreciation, but that wasn't created until 1993, and it's not the charter.
But primarily, most of your asset depreciation is sewer, water, and light.
Right.
Electric.
Okay, so just let me make sure we've got it. We're going to merge.
I'll redo it.
You'll redo it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other comments or suggestions on this particular issue?
Say we go through and try to figure out which one of these, if we agree with all Bill's recommendations for electric, so that John has somewhere to go when he's putting these together.
Yep.
I don't know where I'm going. Don't change the ways.
Just take it for the discussion for what it's worth, I guess. But I feel like we went over these in detail last week too.
Did you want
to? Well, yeah, this is kind of relevant to, but one discussion about the fixed fee, the base fixed fee, and this is a article that I read just a few days after we talked about all that, but apparently a lot of utilities across the country are increasing their base fees because they can't increase rates, so they're increasing the base fee, but what it's creating is a situation to where low users are disincentivized to conserve, and also the low users are generally people in an apartment dwelling that don't use a lot of electricity, they're lower income, and so actually their cost of services are going up, whereas a high consumer, their cost of services are going down. So I think that we have to be real careful if we recommend any kind of base service fee adjustment for a multi-meter situation or dwelling unit, that we don't create a unintended consequence of not making it equitable. That's the point. So I'll just pass this article around. You can read it. It was in a Wisconsin paper, I believe, just recently.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
I can send the link out if we need to, but you can see the color. And just for you to read.
Thank you.
You're
this actually has more to do with recommendation 3.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Right.
Let's see, Tracy, I've left something out that was important. I'm sorry. At the last Water and Light Advisory Board meeting, there was a unanimous vote to support the task force draft recommendation for the Mill Creek substation, for what that's worth.
Can you say that again?
Okay, so I make a report each month to the Water and Light Advisory Board as the progress we're making on the mayor's task force infrastructure. And then I review with them the draft recommendation for the construction of the Mill Creek electrical substation. And then they saw fit that we discussed it, and then they made a motion to endorse that draft recommendation, and unanimously did that. So I don't know, for what that's worth.
Well, it was a draft.
Yeah, the draft. Yeah, it was draft. Yeah, sure enough, it was draft. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the connection fee. Is there anything else we want to weigh in on this?
So I still haven't seen the draft line extension policy that we were supposed to get, so I think we were going to put this on hold until we got that.
I agree. I'd like to see the line extension, see if we even need to explore this any further, depending on what it was resolved, or has it even been read the second time, the extension policy?
Yeah.
Because it hasn't been approved yet, right?
No, okay, from what I know, okay, that was an agenda item at the last Water and Light Advisory Board meeting, and because we were not satisfied with the progress that was making, because this was introduced back in December of 2014, and I mean, this has gone on all of 2015 and all of 2016, and it got hung up in the legal department. And so we requested that the legal department come to the Water and Light Advisory Board meeting and explain to us what the holdup was. And then Kavanaugh Nose started into the discussion of the Hancock Amendment and got into the nitty gritty detail of how the methodology was computed, and which it was computed based upon a cost of service study, and that it created such a discussion that it got to the point that that I made a motion that we call back our consultant and have him re-explain this to us. it got that confusing, and that Kavanaugh got so embedded in the details of this thing, and that he was going to have to know this before he could put his stamp of approval on it to send it on. And so the only thing I needed to do was to call the consultant back in and go over that whole methodology again to for him at the next or at a near future board meeting to
so
get
it
at.
It hasn't left the water and light board. The whole topic of the line.
Well, yeah, it left the Water and Light Advisory Board in early 2015, approved as presented by the consultant. And it went to then, help me out, Tad, then it went through channels and it got to the legal department before it went to the council for approval, and then it's been locked up.
Yeah, I think when it first came through the advisory board, there was some concerns on you know, the Hancock Amendment, so they wanted to kind of get, in addition to everybody else, you know, what's the legal standing before they, as a board, recommend something to council, what's the legal position that they make sure they understand what it is, and that's kind of what they're addressing.
And according to my humble opinion, the Hancock Amendment didn't apply, and that and I present a case law that shows that it doesn't apply, but I'm only the feeble chairman.
And to me, that's just kind of a side note to the recommendation for me. I mean, figure out if you need to do a Hancock Amendment or not, but if it makes sense to do it, I would make a recommendation that you evaluate implementing a line extension fee.
That's right, and we need one.
But I just don't know what that looks like, and I'd like to see what the ones you guys are looking at looks like.
With a connection fee, which could be construed as two different entities.
Yeah. Well, I get a little fuzzy as to, I'm thinking that it's a connection fee, and then I see the verbiage line extension policy. Then I see those as two different animals, and we have a line extension policy
that is being proposed to be revised as part of this. What is the name of this? I don't know what it is. The consultant prepared thing. Is it called a connection fee, or is it called addendum to the line extension policy?
I got it right. Line extension policy. I got it.
They don't rename it as a new connection fee.
It does cover connection.
But really, it's the overall line extension policy that they're revising, new methodology calculating.
Right.
Yeah.
So is the question?
Yeah, I actually got that printed out, and I read through that whole thing.
And that's what he.
Yeah.
And then we're having this gentleman come back.
When is that, John?
When is that, Tan?
I would suspect it would be at the November meeting. October's coming up quick, and the guy just got back recently.
he's been on vacation. So.
Yeah, he's a busy guy. He's got a lot of training.
Oh.
But the line extension fee, the concept that it would not be charged to every new property, every new connection, it's only if that requires a significant circuit to deliver to that?
It recognizes a value of a new customer as part of the process. If you charge over and above the recognized value to the utility, whatever that cost was, if it was greater, if the cost to the utility was greater than the value of the customer, whether a particular customer would get a charge, it would depend. There is a calculation methodology that's reflected in the policy.
Bill, you're proposing that all new development or reconfigured, which requires change in service, be charged a connection fee.
regardless of how much electricity they're going to use.
Or their location within the distribution system. Yeah. So they're right next to the pole, they're still going to get the same fee as if they're, you know, 3 blocks from the pole.
Yeah.
So what would that money go for that is different than the line extension fee?
You go for operation maintenance expenses.
Well, the
total budget.
Yeah, the from a financial standpoint, what you it's not, what happens is you can't put it in the classification of permanent revenue. Mm-hmm. Help me out, Jim. What's that called?
It's variable. I mean, it's
variable or non-permanent revenue on the income and expense statement. Because 1 year you might have $500,000, next year you might have $150,000, and right. And so,
but it would offset the cost of connecting to.
Yeah, it offsets the cost, and it's, you know, in the electrical system, you know, it's $125 million enterprise, and so if it's $1 million, it's $1 million over $125. But again, it's another. It needs to be charged. It's to make it equitable, and that it's not a lifesaver in terms of a grandiose new revenue source that's going to make the lower the rates or whatever. It's not. It's not to that magnitude.
Personally, I'd be in favor of, in theory, I haven't seen it, but I can picture what it is, the bringing up to date and using the most current methodology of this consultant has provided for the line extension policy. I'm in favor of that. In theory, I haven't seen it exactly, but I would not necessarily be in favor of this connection fee, though.
Okay.
Like, or the recommendation as written.
All right, now in the for what it's worth category, I just happened to come upon this in my trusty file, and in these matters, I contact bond counsel, I contact Mr. Al Wilkin of Gilmore and Bell, and he says, John, attach this an appellate court opinion that determined that connection fees are not subject to the Hancock Amendment. In the opinion, you will see that the court used what is known as the five-point test or the Keller test. The test was created by the Missouri Supreme Court in its decision in Keller versus Marion County Ambulance District, cited in the opinion, has been used ever since to determine whether a charge constitutes a tax, license, or fee regarding voter approval. So, for what it's worth, category. I think it's very plain that it's, and that municipalities all through Missouri rely upon that opinion to set connection fees. The other case law is the law is this person versus the city of Blue Springs, and what that one says is when you have voter approved bonds. That the bond ordinance allows you to charge rates, fees, and so on to in within your system by having voter approval of those bonds, you can change connection fees, add fees, and rates, and so on, charges, as long as you have indebtedness. And the reason they allow you to do that is that was voter approved. And that court case is used many, many, many times.
I just wondering why you felt you couldn't support a connection fee for electricity.
Because I think I think it's being taken into account. It should be taken into account in the line extension policy.
We have no line extension policy, though, do we?
We do. This is just an update to it, right?
Well,
there is fees like. The developer, you have a whole policy on what the developer is responsible for when you extend electric. So,
right,
I mean,
that's
all.
Right now for doing the trenching and installing the conduit.
And if you have a dedicated transformer, it's all on the developer.
Right.
And if you have to go from the primary, it's the developers
right.
for the circuit. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's all already kind of written. It's not like there's a free. Here, the city's building all your electric, and you don't have to pay anything. The developer pays a lot for electric. So.
Okay, let's
let's ask this question maybe to get at it, Cody. Jim, what is the water connection fee? I build a house and you come and set my meter. What do you charge me?
Those are fixed cost fees except for the system equity charge.
Okay, so it's $550.
I don't remember the number.
I'll just say $550.
That's
okay. And so
the system equity fee. Yes.
Okay, then you set my electric meter. What do you charge me?
Nothing.
Okay.
There's a big difference in price.
I know, but that's kind of what we're...
The difference is that the electric utility can recoup that through rate much faster than the other utilities.
Absolutely,
so,
yes.
That's, but I don't but know it, that that's...
But I can see Cody's point. And I can right now developers are used to that shared cost arrangement where they're putting in the circuit pass... And the city's coming in and pulling the circuits and setting the transformer, so it's a shared cost of delivery. And then the city's costs are going to be recouped through rate for that particular customer over a period of time, in theory.
Yeah.
But the other option is to pull back and say, well, we're not sure we can recoup all that in rate and to charge some level of a fee,
I think that's,
or redefine the.
That's why I'm hesitant to add another fee because I'm sure this line extension policy will increase the amount the developers pay right now. Not going to go down.
Yeah. I would recommend that they, as they're proceeding, is maybe not go down this path. I think you can put this as a suggestion in the line extension study to reevaluate that to make sure that it's fair and equitable for all development and that the common ratepayer that is not involved in that development is not paying for that development. I think that's what the concern is. A normal electric consumer, I don't want to be paying for the development in the downtown area.
Or anywhere.
Correct. Anywhere, yeah.
Now, electric rates will increase 2% Monday night, which we had electric connection fee.
No. 2% of $125 million is $2.5 million, and if you add $500,000 in those connection fee bills, that's a what's $500,000 over 2.5? I mean, it's a.
So we don't do it because it's not a big amount.
Well, no, it's not a big amount. Is you can't count on it. How do you predict that? How do you predict all of it?
Parks and recreation fees. People going to the Ark.
People doing what?
How does Parks and Recreation care fees?
Yeah, I've always wondered that, how they do that. They have a cost of service study?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either.
They don't count on variable fees.
I don't know either.
It's sort of practice.
Yeah, it's like the golf courses. There's no debt on that golf courses, but they keep raising the green fees, the cart fees.
Salaries go up.
I have a question about the line extension fee from a consumer perspective or sort of a political perspective.
Uh-huh.
The formula for it sounds complicated. I'm not a flat tax person here at all, but it sounds complicated. The public is going to have a hard time understanding how. So what sort of analysis, what sort of annual evaluation are we put out that demonstrates that you're equitably charging new development or new connections?
Well, each one will be evaluated based on its the cost associated with it. So it is the methodology is outlined, and each one will be individually for what their required payment is, and it'll be a public record. I mean, it's not a.
It tries to assess the impact on the utility that we charge the customer.
Right.
And mathematics. It's still an estimate, right? Because you don't really know how much electricity that a new development's going to use.
Correct.
So well, is there, the, and the, who's the, making that assessment? Is it
the estimate of the value of the customer is based on historical usage patterns of my customers. And within a time period for residential, it's 7 years, because even if you're you're going to get turnover in houses. And then as you get into larger buildings, like you get into industries, it's only 3 years because they may build and leave, but it might be. So it's there are, yeah, I mean, everything is based on an estimate, right? I mean,
you didn't take that, did you?
But it's fairly refined estimates.
Just kidding.
Not just pulling a number out.
It's not just the developer saying, well, we're only going to use this.
No. It's based on a like customer base, not on the estimate of the development.
Yeah, and are these industry standards, or is this something that's calculated locally, or how to?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it'll be applied locally. I mean,
right.
The consultant has done this in numerous locations.
Right.
And so what we want you to think is that, and this is not any different than cost of service study for the electric or cost of service study for the sewer or cost of service study for the water, is that in this report, what you can imagine, all this is a spreadsheet after spreadsheet. And so when you go to revise something that's a spreadsheet, what do? You just put the new data in and it recomputes it, and then you find out if did it go up or go down. And so you have as a part of that service they provide, you get the spreadsheet. Yeah, and the same thing for the other cost of service studies, and it allows the staff to
prediction.
Yeah,
the line extension would, at what point would that evaluation be completed? What connection size?
Any.
Even down to residential.
Oh yeah.
So you have actually about four categories.
And there is a distinction between the type of residential, whether it's all electric or it's not.
And you know, for myself, I think I think we need it. That's another business practice that we need to incorporate and have on the books.
So, what's your revenue generation estimate for this current proposal for the line extension study?
We actually don't have one.
I don't think we have one yet. We historically look at the.
I think sure it would fluctuate a lot depending on
right.
Past performance.
Yeah, you know, for.
We get a lot of new applications and some years we don't. So
and, you know, right now, 95% of the electric revenue is from metered. Mm-hmm. The majority of the rest of that is really off of market sales and our transmission system, not off of other fees we charge. I mean, we do fiber optics makes, you know, several hundred thousand a year, so there's other fees. But we wouldn't look at this probably for a few years. You know, we estimate very low on what the revenue would be.
Yeah.
And then see what it was. I mean, when you're starting a new program like this, basically, you can't say you're going to have $1 million a year in revenue, and end up to be $100,000.
No, a simplified look at it would be like this. There's 48,000 customers, say. So what, and we had a 1% growth. So 1% of 48,000 is what? 480. That check out there, 480. And say the connection fee was $1,000. So it's 1,000 times 480. It's $480,000. That's another way to kind of get your.
You can look at the water connection fee also. It's what, say, $550? Sewer connection fees.
$1,600.
$2,000 now.
Yeah, $2,000.
But you look at the last 5 years, see what each one of those fees brought in. Mm-hmm. You can compare what they brought in, then you could judge.
Now you can look at the trend of them and make the judgment from there. That's what that guy over there does. See, he's good at that. No, that's right. I mean, we look at the trend of what the.
I mean, the line extension goes all the way to all customers that don't know that having a fee. Makes sense. I mean, as long as the analysis is done that shows the electric utility is going to recoup all that expense and not carry that burden over to the rest of the ratepayers, then it meets the intent. Adding a fee may not do that. It may be short or may be high.
Yeah, see, I would agree. But another way,
kind of complicated than just taxing a fee.
Well, it is, but another simplistic way of looking at this, let's say that we don't have it, okay? Then it would be apparent to me that there's a subsidy going on, okay? And so to get rid of that notion, then you need a connection fee. Or is it perfect? No, but we're going to get at it pretty precisely to make it a part of the charges.
Back up your logic on you jump from if there's not a connection fee, there has to be subsidy.
Yeah, just like on the water. Take away the $5.50.
What about the line extension policy? I thought that was taken into account, the value of the customer and...
But there's no charge for it.
If the value said that they didn't need a charge, that value, that just because you're not paying doesn't mean your value is automatically, they're subsidizing you. But yeah, they're subsidizing you based on the value you're providing, so it's not a subsidy, it's a trade, or, you know, I don't know, okay. I'm saying that right, but...
Cross-subsidy. No, I'm just kidding. I hear what you're saying.
You could also perceive that as lost income, because if you charge a connection fee to cover the cost of connecting, you're gaining that revenue, that
you're
income
offsetting.
Immediately. You're and offsetting. That income would be offset across the board for all ratepayers.
Yep.
So that's one way to look at it as well.
That's the way it works. Yep. Yep. And a public utility, that's the...
Correct.
So are there some kinds of uses that would always... generate a fee? It seems like there are some kinds of uses that would be more likely to not incur the fee than others. Like, wouldn't residential always incur a fee?
It would depend on the lot sizes, but probably there would. Certainly, you know, large lot developments would probably, because of the cost associated with running all of that distance. The one distinction I would disagree with John slightly on, water and electric are substantially different. We're going to probably cross the 50,000 customer mark in the next year for electric, and water's not far behind. So we have the same customer base, essentially. But you're talking about a $125 million operation versus a $25 million operation. So just the spread of cost is significantly different. So that connection fee makes a little more sense on the water side because of the value per customer versus on the electric side. And once again, on the quantity that any one customer can buy from each utility. So if this extension policy addresses some of that cost of getting the new customer, it's whether or not a connection fee, I would argue that it wouldn't be necessary. Plus, it's very difficult to do it on the electric side because we don't have the records we do on the water side. Water is based on meter size, and that's a very apparent thing. On the electric side, you'd almost have to base it on the size of the service, which we haven't ever tracked. So we allocate the cost on the water side because of the meter size, and we know that. On the electric side, we don't have that information, so it would be a difficult thing to determine how do we allocate costs when we don't know what we currently have, and then as the new customers come on, if that makes sense.
Is there a general concern that people are over metering their electricity? I mean, I thought it was safer to have a bigger than smaller box if you were on the edge of capacity.
Well, it's not that. It's just that, you know, the only point we have is the transformer, and many times the transformer can serve more than one customer.
Right.
There are certainly a lot of customers, especially on the commercial side, where it's one-to-one. But certainly in the residential, it's often one and many. Mm-hmm. So whether customer A is using half of that transformer and customer B is only using a tenth of it, I mean, we don't have a good way of determining.
You have to go by square foot by building type.
And yeah, I mean, it's just one way, which is different crude, but way of how would we establish.
Now, the way to collect the data over time would be to implement more AMI to where you have data on all commercial types of residential commercial buildings. And maybe one of the recommendations we could make in this group would be to, as Cody talked about a little bit, is implementing AMI on a pilot scale on categories of buildings so you can start collecting that data to understand the demands for each of the types of services.
And to make a summary point, is the reason we go to Utility Financial Solutions, the consultant, is that he lives in a big world of these clients and customers and situations, and has a broad knowledge of the methodologies and so on, and he can look at our utility and bring us to a point of reasonableness of what we should be charging, and that's what I go with.
So I do have a question from the sort of public perception perspective: is are there with the line equity fee? Are there types of uses, types of customers that are going to be more likely to be charged versus not being charged?
No, everybody gets charged.
Well, not necessarily everybody.
Well, don't you got to fall into one of those categories?
Well, but once again, there is a value of customer. So if the value of the customer is greater than the cost of the installation, there would be no charge.
So who's a valuable customer? I mean, what makes somebody valuable?
Well, would you pay the customer to connect?
Check your credit rating too. Make sure you pay your bill.
You would not pay the customer to connect. Yeah. But we would not necessarily charge the customer. And it is based on the methodology described. It is dependent upon the situation. So if there is a, there's a feeder that has 2 megawatts. and there's an open lot that's right next to it. Then that customer may not pay anything. I mean, it's going to be based on the type of customer, the cost involved, and the payback anticipated. I mean, I don't have a better answer.
So would it do away with what's already in place then in favor of this
method? There would still be an incentive for the developer to go ahead and do the trenching. Because if they don't, then we have to do it, and that's going to increase the cost, and so it's going to push
the cost.
And
they're going to have to wait.
Right. So it's,
it still uses a shared cost concept to deliver the cost to the customer.
Right, because it's still what is the cost to the utility? And so if we retake over the trenching and the conduit, then that just increases our cost. So it's...
I think there's still an incentive for the customer to reduce the utility's cost.
And it's very convenient for them. I mean, that's based on their timing. And because I was in the discussions when we worked this all out, and, that was one of the things was that
they want control,
of how to do this, right? They want to do the trenching.
They don't want to wait for us to show up when we don't know if they like
it. Right.
They fit their schedule.
Right.
Wouldn't the revenue from a line extension possibly still be variable revenue?
Sure.
So it's more or less, you can set either one, either the connection fee or the variable revenue fee to meet what you need to operate with.
Could, but the line extension is better defined. But you can't set it to define what you need to do because you're not getting that much revenue.
But it's more difficult to understand for the consumer.
Sometimes that works that way. It's more difficult to understand, but it's more accurate with how the expenses are incurred.
Kind of like a demand charge.
Exactly.
Demand charge is fairly easy to understand.
But there's
you turn everything on.
A straight connection fee has no incentive to reduce your impact to the system. In other words, if you get a line extension fee and you're creating a significant burden, you've got large cable, large transformation service, you're going to pay more for that. And if you design your facility, building, whatever it may be, that you can minimize that, that's a financial, that lowers your cost to connect. If you have a connection fee, you lose that. There's no incentive. You're going to pay the fee, and you get to connect.
Right, which is why the methodology was used of really trying to isolate the rest of the customers from this customer's adverse impact.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Analyze what's the impact.
Right. So you have incentive to reduce your impact at cost to connect. That way your cost is going to be zero, and I think it provides more incentive. So that line extension fee option versus a straight simple fee.
Right. I'm still trying to understand what this will incentivize and disincentivize. So is will you pay more or less based on intensifying your use of land, or is there a geographic component to it, or?
Well, as a general statement, it probably encourages intensive
Well, it would encourage development when there's already infrastructure.
Yeah, that's right. Be more efficient. Yeah.
Okay, so a line gets extended because you're building farther out or because you need a bigger line, right? Simply.
And there's significant, if it's 5-acre lots, that's going to cost more.
Yeah. This town is large enough that you're going to have such a variability. I mean, there's all kinds of different variability.
So it incentivizes efficient
where all the open land
housing
and lots
and residential commercial properties versus sprawl.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's safe to say that the policy would not incentivize sprawl because it takes a longer, it's more costly.
Right. That's what you kind of want to avoid, is that urban sprawl.
Or if you're going to do it, that's just part of the cost.
So I think a recommendation should be explicit that we understand that and that the readers understand that.
I'd agree.
Okay. So we beat that horse to death. What do we do to resolve the difference in one regarding a flat fee versus in recommending that the line extension fee policy be adopted?
Well, I'd like to see that we just take a vote on the two, but we don't have the option to draft it to take a vote on which one we would prefer. Line extension, pursue the line extension policy if we pursue a flat fee. To me, that's the two options that we have. But you can't recommend both.
Yeah, and that was...
recommend one or the other, which one do we want to recommend?
Yeah. And that was really...
You can prioritize.
Yeah. You could recommend both in terms of, maybe if we... For example, if we decided that we were going to encourage the line extension policy as our number one, and then, but if they don't want to move forward on that, then the option would be connection fee.
Yeah.
Can we please get through this customer charge issue tonight, or attempt to?
Base charge?
The base charge, yes. And I, this article doesn't surprise me, and I have to say I'm just missing something here, but it's not.
I agree with the article.
You agree with the article?
Yes.
So how does it fit into the recommendation?
The customer fee would be less than the current base charge or minimum charge. Electric minimum charge is currently $15.60. The customer fee would be nowhere near that high.
But it would make up for it because every unit would pay a customer fee.
Yes.
But I don't know that every unit should be paying the exact same customer fee.
Yes.
It should be by rate class.
Well, that would be similar classified unit.
Yeah, because the apartment will not use the same as a 2,000 square foot home. So they shouldn't be paying the same customer fee or same base fee.
They're paying the same minimum charge now.
Right. But I'm just saying that if it's an apartment dwelling, you should have such a high base fee or customer fee is they're disincentivized to become more efficient. Mm-hmm. I don't use very much natural gas during the summer. I pay mostly the Ameren minimum charge for my gas. And electric, and you can see an apartment complex, somebody dialing everything down and putting in efficient lighting, and then they lose their incentive because they've taken their energy rate away. So it has to be tiered by rate class, in my mind.
I can agree with that too.
You can see the same about houses though too.
Like correct.
If in a house you're paying $15 and in an apartment you pay pennies on your base charge, essentially, comparatively, then there's no incentive for the person in the house to decrease their rates. So if you balance that out a little bit better, maybe everybody's in the same.
If you've got an individual electric meter now, you're paying the same minimum charge whether you're in a house or an apartment you want.
Right, but if
$15.60 a month.
But if I'm understanding the quote unquote problem correctly, that the apartment buildings where they're all
master meter
off of 1 meter, yeah, then it's not by unit, so then they're not paying the same amount as the house.
No, they're not.
So this would even that out, is what you're saying.
Yes.
I can't necessarily support what Bill has drafted, but I think we talked a little bit last time, and I could support something that would be more in the nature of our next cost of services study, that the base fee be reevaluated to provide more equity and also address the master metering or missing a customer base in a base charge.
That's what I would piggyback on that. And right. I've written
something.
We can't
decide to tell someone to specifically do it, but we could at least ask that the next service study be
the way I know it, though. The way I know it is the cost.
Electric
is evaluated on cost of service every time.
Yeah, it is. That's true. I know what
base charge is.
Appropriate. Yeah. And I would point out
that it's a fixed cost consideration.
Yes, it is. As I explained, the base charge for water and electric is based on the customer related cost and the meter cost and meter reading ability. You can charge. You have, in the first place, there's maybe three or four apartment complex that are master metered in electric, Gove Towers, Pacman Towers, subsidized housing. It is not an issue in Columbia today. It is evolving because of technology. But once again, it's based on the service that you have, not on some arbitrary thing that you need to charge for. It's not an equitable, it is already equitable based on cost of service. I don't know how to explain that otherwise. We already do it. And as far as, what these other utilities are doing, our rate structure, the first 300 kilowatt hours are the cheapest energy you could purchase. We have a base charge that takes into consideration a minimal, what does it take to provide you with 1 kilowatt hour. That's the part of the distribution system. The rest of it is all of the other customer-related charges. So arbitrarily charging other customers, whoever that might be, I don't understand the concept. And these, you know, a lot of these utilities are trying to push their entire distribution cost into the base charge. When you get up into those hundreds of dollars, and you can look at Boone Electric. Boone Electric charges $20, but part of that is because they have these long runs between customers. We are concentrated. So that our customer costs are less because of that. So that's part of the cost of service analysis.
I've done sewer rate studies where the client wanted their debt service and their bond reserve annual payment
in the base fee.
In the minimum. And used it. And then they wanted all their fixed costs of their system in that minimum. But they wanted that debt service in the minimum so they could assure that they were going to collect enough money to pay their bonds and fund their bond reserve. And
so what was in the rate?
Pardon?
What was in the rate part?
The variable cost.
Okay.
And what do we do is it would be like this, Tracy, if it's $100,000 revenue and that minimum generated $40,000, then the $60,000 divided by the non-winter quarter or the winter quarter usage, mm-hmm. and then became your variable rate. And the other thing it did for them is it simplified annually. They could recompute the rate just to see. I mean, it's just a two-step rate, and one of those just fixed and no usage, and it was really easy for them to compute. And but there you get all kinds of variations, and that's driven somewhat by the if any sewer system gets an SRF loan, then they have a methodology they want to, they call it proportionality,
I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that any dwelling unit using city electricity should pay a fee.
And I'm opposed just for the sake of paying a fee?
Just for the sake of using city electricity. A minimum charge, like $5, or a customer charge of $5. Whether occupied or vacant, because there's an expense to the city for maintaining the infrastructure, whether the property is vacant or occupied. And every unit would pay the same customer charge for a residential dwelling unit, whether it's a mansion, whether it's an apartment.
So basically, we could have what you're suggesting is you could have your base fee and then a customer fee and then your rate charges.
No, it wouldn't. The customer charge would be the base charge.
If the issue is about equity, and maybe we just
then that wouldn't be equitable,
right? We have a different understanding of equity. But
I would be benefited that someone's not paying that would be penalized, and they're generally an apartment lower income would be paying more for their energy than I'd be paying less.
Yes,
right.
That's actually true. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you did. It's like a flat tax. It's sort of like a flat tax.
It is a flat tax.
Right. Which is a regressive idea, right? I mean, $5 is more important to some, is a bigger percentage of their income if you make $100 a month than if you make $10,000.
Well, they're paying $15.50 now. Minimum charge.
Whoever's paying the
utility. I just question the base charge is that a big. Is it the appropriate? And that's what a rate of service study would and analyze. Is it the appropriate value?
Right.
And is it, you know, equitable, or is it slightly regressive in Columbia? Because we do have a lot of apartments. Even though everyone has to have their meter read, a lot of them have less service than others.
Could we make a recommendation as evaluate equity of base charges for master meter versus individual meter, as well as ensuring customers are properly classified so they're not unintentionally subsidizing other classes as part of the next electric cost of service study. The task force has identified the following areas that should be investigated. And then we go through all bills, assess customer charge, whether the utility meter is active on or off, discount customer charge when the meter service is off, place a customer charge to be billed to the property owner when it is not paid by the account holder within the limits of state law. You know, not it wouldn't account for the rate not being paid, but base customer charge based on the electric service. All the ones that Bill had there, but we're not saying do it. We're just saying these are places to look at next time you do a cost of service study.
Well, in the first place, we don't even identify any master meter electric customers. I mean, I happen to know that back when Oak Towers have one meter.
University Village.
Pardon?
University Village.
Right. University Village is another one. And this retirement place down on Bethel, because a specific amendment to our ordinances was made to accommodate them, because they are putting in centralized HVAC and possibly solar.
Backup generation.
Backup generation.
We should allow that privilege so that
These customers are not residential. They pay demand and energy, and it's a totally different concept. And I know that's difficult for some to understand, but it is the reality that they move into a completely different classification of customer. And so we don't have a way of splitting those out and saying we're ignoring their demand and charging them at a residential rate.
If that's what, yeah, I mean, sure. That's why I'm just saying it's something that should be investigated. If it could be evaluated against these two classes, and if it can't be, if it already is, then great.
So is University Village that?
It's the one over there on campus, or at the
University and College.
College and University.
It used to be called Tiger Tires.
You know, I could easily see that there'd be more master meter installations in the future.
Sure.
Because the cost of centralized heating and cooling system is going to be much less costly and much more efficient in the use of energy than individual systems. To the point where if you have, you know, plug load and LED lighting, the individual customer is not going to have a large electric bill.
Right.
And so you're really not going to have the revenue to put in a separate meter. To justify a separate meter.
I'm not talking about requiring separate meters, I'm talking about charging appropriately.
Yeah. But they're charged through their master meter connection, through the meter connection and demand.
Right.
And then their energy use.
I'm just saying, evaluate whether that's appropriate or not.
Okay, well, if we frame it the way that Cody described, can we come to consensus that we've addressed that issue?
Good to hear.
Yeah, okay. So like see draft and then the final language. But,
oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take into consideration.
All right, so in the matter of time, do we have any general comments?
Can I ask John?
Jim?
We're not guests.
All right.
Guest is volunteer. Volunteer to come in.
I feel compelled that we gotta give something to Tony. He wasn't here tonight, so I think he's.
I'll shoot him an email.
Well, get him. Make him do something. Make him draft something or give him
the... Yeah, the one I said about evaluate equity.
We have the transcript, the recording.
He can do the minutes.
That rascal wasn't here tonight, so he... Yeah.
All right. All right, anything else
we'll
for the...
attendance
go to the cause? All right, we're adjourned. The cause? All right, we're adjourned.